This is John Amis in London, and today we're talking about film music. The March from Things to Come by Sir Arthur Bliss, an early classic among film scores. A colleague of mine has recently been collecting views about their work for films from some of the best-known British composers, and here he is to introduce them, Kenyon Emrys Roberts.
Not long ago, I arranged to meet seven of our leading film composers, who ranged from the doyens of the industry, Sir Arthur Bliss and William Aylwin, through by way of Alan Rawsthorne to the post-war generation of Malcolm Arnold, Anthony Hopkins, John Addison, and youngest of all, Richard Rodney Bennett. What they had to say ran to many hours. Today, we're going to dip into some of their thoughts and experiences and hear of the problems and aims of creating music for films. First, to Sir Arthur Bliss.
I think, really, in writing for the films, I was tempted first by the excitement of a new medium. I've written music for the opera stage, for ballet, for concert hall, for chorus, chamber music, soloists, brass bands, of course. The only medium I hadn't tried was the film, and that was a great incentive to me to see what the problems were. And the second thing about writing music for a film is that I find it a very good discipline for a composer. Begin with, he has to use the blue pencil, which he might do with a great deal of advantage sometimes in the concert hall. You have a time sequence lasting 3.5 minutes. You write the music, which you think fits the scene like a glove. The cutter comes in, cuts it down to 45 seconds. You have got to get in those 45 seconds exactly the same punch as you did in 3.5 minutes, and that is a discipline.
Sir Arthur Bliss is not the only composer who recalls the early days with affection. Here's William Aylwin.
Immediately, one was swept into this excitement of writing for an absolutely new medium, a medium that you was a discovery from the very beginning. Every move you made was a new move. I wish I could get across to you, perhaps I am getting across to you, the feeling of intense excitement at that time. It was an excitement shared by so many composers all over the world, and some who have made great names. People like Benjamin Britten, Onega, Prokofiev, and Paul Roth, who was the most experimental of the directors of documentary films then. Paul and I used to get together in the cutting rooms and try and invent means of experiment. We did the first experiments with running the sound backwards. We used not only the voice track running backwards and running at different pitches, but we used reverse cymbals. The music, for instance, for a lift ascending was simply recorded backwards for it going down again. At the same time in France, Onega was experimenting with electronic music.
Besides the director of the film and the composer, there used often to be a third man involved, the music director, as Alan Rawsthorne explains.
I think the duties of a music director in a film company include that of being, as it were, an interpreter between what the director of the picture has to say and what the composer is to understand, because directors of pictures very often are not particularly conversant with musical language, and it's a little difficult to get at what they mean. Consequently, the music director has to be there, or should be there, all the time during the preliminary discussions, of which there should be a number. You see, I feel that a very essential thing in writing films is to go through, having decided where the music is to come, to go through each music sequence, each cue, with the director, and find out precisely what he thinks the music ought to be doing.
Alan Rawsthorne's views about the problem of the different languages of film and music are shared by Malcolm Arnold.
The difference in talking about music and describing music between people who work in films, I don't mean musicians, I mean film directors and producers, and the difference from the way musicians talk about music is so vast that you need a way of interpreting this. I mean, the director who comes up, it is a favourite case that you always find this. The director who comes along and says you must have, he wants something very imaginative and completely unfettered and let your imagination run riot. You know exactly what he wants. He wants Rachmaninoff, and he wants nothing more than the Rachmaninoff Second Piano Concerto. And many young composers have been told this, and they've come up with something extraordinarily right off, offbeat, you know, and wondered why the director and producer has been disappointed. Well, it's in the way of talking about it, you see.
I asked Malcolm Arnold how he preferred to work, from the script or from the finished film.
I like to read the script first, because then if it's something that's completely alien to you, you know immediately that you can't do it, and you don't waste any more time. But then having read the script, unless there is a musical sequence of people dancing or singing in the film, you usually don't see any more of the makers of the film until there is a rough cut. The rough version of the film, it's all been shot, and then you come in and seriously start work. Unless, of course, as I say, there are dancing sequences or singing sequences, then you write the music first, record it, and they film it, as you know, to the recorded music.
Sir Arthur Bliss works in much the same way.
Well, I don't say I want to be in on scripting, but I'd like to see very early on the rushes of this film to get the atmosphere of it. What's this film about? What kind of thing? Is it very comic? Is it tragic? Or is it, what is it? Romantic? So that I'm not left at the last moment, as one is so often, with a lot of music to write and no time to do it. You see, I orchestrate all my music that I write for the films. Some composers, I believe, farm it out, but I can't do it because the sound I want is the only sound I can give it. And the result is there's an enormous lot of notes to be put down on paper.
Bliss then orchestrates all his own music. Richard Rodney Bennett is one of the younger school of British composers, and his thinking is different.
Once I remember in a film I had to do music for a Boy Scout band. Now, I wrote the tune myself, but I think if I'd scored it myself, I would have started to invent, so to speak. And what one wanted, what one frequently wants, is just a straight use of that particular style, which is not really a composer's territory. It's an orchestrator's territory. And I quite often, I never give, so to speak, original music to anybody to orchestrate, as is done in Hollywood. But if I want a particular music suggesting a brass band or whatever it may be, I give it to somebody to score who is particularly qualified in that field.
One feels that they have the clichés of the trade.
They have the clichés of the trade. They can do it. They can do it better than a composer would.
I asked Richard Rodney Bennett if he'd come across the theme song problem, that's to say, having to fit in with a theme tune already written by another composer.
I have. I've done two pictures. One was rather embarrassing because I was sent to Hollywood to discuss music for a picture, and when I got there I found there was one of these theme songs, which was by a good songwriter, but unfortunately it was a very bad tune, and you're stuck with it. There's nothing you can do, and this is one, I'm afraid, one of the worst problems one has to contend with, because if you have a bad tune, what can you do? I mean, you can dress it up, but basically it's a bad tune and that's all there is to it. And I'm afraid there, again, there is this fallacy that composers are incapable of writing good theme songs, and I think Malcolm Arnold is the answer to this.
I only have one standard, and it may sound very simple, but it's the only one that I can use, and that is I write what I would like to hear if I happen to be in the audience. There's a strange division in all music, from a concert hall downwards. There's this division between the pure musician who thinks in terms of putting notes together and the history of music and such abstract, slightly abstract things, if you see what I mean, and the person who thinks in terms of drama and emotion in music. The film composer has got to think in these terms, in terms of drama, emotion, and movement. And it's very difficult for a person who's had an academic musical training, as is any person who can really do the job must have to a certain extent. It's very difficult to do the simple thing, because sometimes you feel as though you might be cheating, and you make your music more complicated, and from the dramatic or emotional point of view, you kill it stone dead. This happens so often.
The simple thing is so easy to listen to, and often so difficult to create. Does this mean that the more advanced techniques of modern music are out? William Arwin.
One can use the whole technique of music in films. I've even used serial music in films. I wrote an entire score in serial music.
Oh, which film was that?
A fairly recent film called Life for Ruth.
Oh, one would never have known it.
Well, the orchestra didn't know it. It was only when I pointed out to them on the very last day of the third session that they'd been playing exactly the same 12 notes in the different, in the same arrangement or backwards throughout, that they realised what they'd been doing. 12-note music isn't necessarily angular music. You can write certain tunes with it.
The stamp of an Arwin score is that he tailors his music to lead firmly from one dramatic point to another.
I have a horror of music being used entirely as atmosphere, in other words, drifting in, drifting out. I think that music should be motivated by an action or a sentence and should finish at a dramatic point, if it's being used dramatically. But I'm hoping and very much that there'll be a definite trend to less music. It seems extraordinary that a composer should plead for less music. But you see that in any dramatic film, any dramatic music, you're as dependent on silence as you are dependent on sound.
Where do film composers draw their inspiration from? One logical source is the location itself, as John Addison illustrates.
Well, in case, for instance, the film Taste of Honey, I went up to Manchester because I had a feeling that in that part of England, if one went into a pub there, one would still hear people making their own music and that I might pick up some strange instrument. What I did find there was a lot of the street games of children, which were to play an important part in the film. I did quite a bit of research about children's songs, and then we simply walked into schools there and they were extremely cooperative and, you know, the work would stop. And then we'd get hold of the children and try to get us to do some of the songs they sang.
Oh, and of course you had this the Good Ship Sails in the Alley Alley O.
Yes, well, that was one of them. It's an old children's song, a well-known one.
And it tied up so well with the Manchester Ship Canal, which was the setting of the film.
Oh, the big ship sails on.
But a composer's inspiration can often come in the most indirect fashion, as Anthony Hopkins found when he was working with Peter Ustinov on Billy Budd, his largest film score to date.
Well, it's not just a simply a question of it being the largest score. It was the score which I can really say was the only time I've ever worked in a film and really felt a deep sense of artistic satisfaction about the project on which I was engaged. Because I do feel tremendously that usually the composer has a raw deal from an artistic point of view, because directors and producers are extraordinarily insensitive about their handling of music. They just use it as a sort of cushion to cover up bad sections of dialogue. They swamp a film in music. Working with Ustinov on Billy Budd, I felt I was involved in a really artistic project where the music was used with discretion and with imagination and with a really constructive sense of what it could do to help the film.
What emotional effect, then, did Ustinov want for his music?
Well, I think the sea and compassion perhaps allied to loneliness, the loneliness of the sea in those days, without radar and without radio and without any communication without the ship, sometimes for days on end. And so throughout the score there is a sort of emptiness, a sort of yearning feeling, which comes through, I hope, very much in the music. I think an example of this, which rather fascinated me, was in the very opening music. I went for a holiday in Sardinia, where you don't, in fact, get very rough seas on the whole. And I used to lie on the beach there, imagining the sound of sea, knowing that I was going to write this film. And in my mind's ear, there came with a quite astonishing clarity the actual sound of the very opening of this film. And when I first saw the opening of the film, which had been shot elsewhere and which I'd had nothing to do with at all, I found that the ship that we saw coming up the channel was moving in exact rhythm to the music that I had visualized. I didn't have to change a single note. I mean, it just flowed into the movement of the waves so naturally. And this is a very gratifying thing.
Talking to all these composers, I found the subject of relations between composer and director was always being raised. Here are two more views, first from Richard Rodney Bennett, and then from William Alwyn.
I find when working on film music, that the two easiest type of directors to work with are first the director who isn't there at all and isn't at all interested in what happens to his film, because then you have a completely free hand. But this is not, after all, the ideal answer. The ideal answer is a director like Joe Losey or John Schlesinger, both of whom I found it a great pleasure to work for, and they were very vitally concerned with what one did, but they didn't try and interfere. They gave one all sorts of leads, but basically they respected one's, identity as a creative artist, and they left one a free hand, apart from suggesting various leads, and this is very stimulating. A bad director will use you just a sort of just another technician.
If you get a great director like Carol Reed, particularly I'm thinking of his early films like Odd Man Out, Fallen Idol, The Way Ahead, True Glory,
yes,
the planning of the music was essential to his actual shooting, that he would plan scenes where he knew he could rely entirely on the music.
He was a master at blending music and effects.
Yes, because he was he's pernickety over those things. A soundtrack is the perfect blend of the actors' voices, the sound effects, and the music. Now that means that your director has to have a very good idea of the ultimate sound that he wants to make, and the musician must work absolutely hand and glove with the sound effects man.
But the old problem was when a director wanted everything. There was a scene in Things to Come where motorcycles, police tear down a road, and Corder insisted upon not only having the noise, the tearing and scrunching noise of 50 motorbicycles, but he wanted music on top. And hours I spent saying either one or the other, but not both. But he insisted on both.
Alan Rawsthorne had the most extreme experience in this direction.
Very often you don't know what sound effects the editor is going to put on the film when you're writing the music. I remember once writing some music for a film which was, took place in the 18th century in a sort of baroque atmosphere. It was about the Elector of Hanover, his son, who was subsequent to King George I of England. And there was a great wedding scene in a cathedral. And there was a great piece of music had to be written for this, and we had the Philharmonia Orchestra. And we had half a brass band who happened to be hanging about at the same time, so I'd written parts into them, you know, flugelhorns and euphoniums and all sorts of things. And we recorded this music. Then the director and the producer didn't seem to be quite happy about it, and Ernest Irving and I, and they talked about it. What I could make out, they didn't seem to think it was loud enough. So Ernest Irving and I put our heads together, and we couldn't think what else we could put in, till somebody had the brainwave of going to Ealing Parish Church. And we got the organist, and he and I and Ernest Irving played a sort of trio on this organ. The organist was aged about 106, and Ernest Irving was more or less crippled with rheumatoid arthritis, and I can't play the organ anyhow. But between us, we managed to produce, I thought, a real old hullabaloo, and we added this. Well, when it came to the dubbing, I could see why they thought the music wasn't very satisfactory, because on the top of it, they had put cheering crowds, rattling vehicles in the street, a peal of bells, which they'd imported from Prague, I remember, and a bishop intoning the service, a few choir boys, rain on the roof, and then they topped it up with a violent thunderstorm.
What was the name of this film?
It was called Saliban for Dead Lovers. Yes.
Effects of a very different kind can be achieved with a film director who anticipates what a composer can do for him. Malcolm Arnold.
Yes, well, this does actually happen. I mean, this happens with directors who are very conscious of sound and music. I mean, David Lean, for instance, and also Sir Carol Reed, they often shoot scenes specifically with the effect that a musician is going to add to it in mind, and they shoot scenes that are much longer, knowing purposely, not in the sense that music is going to cover anything up, but in order to help the musician, to help them. This is very often done without the actual suggestion of the musician, but it's based on what the musician, what the composer has done previously. They suddenly think, oh, well, that composer, I know what he'll do here, I must make this scene a little longer, and this is the way they shoot. But of course, a classic example of this was in the David Lean picture of the sound barrier, where it was deliberately, the opening was designed to use sound and music. If you remember, it started just with the sea sound, then a mouth organ, and you saw a soldier playing a mouth organ, lying in the sun. It was obviously wartime. You saw a crashed Messerschmitt and a soldier playing this mouth organ. In the distance, you heard the sound of a Spitfire. And from the sound of a Spitfire, music came in and carried without any aeroplane noise, and the Spitfire was doing what David Lean liked to call a Spitfire ballet, to almost sort of aeroplane sort of Tchaikovsky music. It was a ballet sequence, and then danger began, the wings started juddering, and sound effects took over.
Malcolm Arnold quoted a scene where music and sound effects were dominant partners in the action. In general, however, the composer has to accept that the drama on the scene is all, as Alan Rawsthorne noted.
You see, I believe that you have, if you're a film composer, you have to get used to the idea of writing, as it were, on different planes of almost of consciousness. You have to write music which is going to make an effect without the audience being aware that it is being played at all. You have to be able to emerge from that at odd moments so that you really do hit the audience between the eyes with something or other, and then back again to a kind of subconscious level of music.
Finally, what about the trends that film music is, or should be, taking today? William Alwyn.
Well, I think that the trends that it should have been taking are the very trends that it started with. Not enough experimenting is done with film music. We're still conditioned by the large orchestra, not perhaps quite so much now. We're still conditioned by too much music. We're still conditioned by the attitude of the composer who feels that his music has an importance outside the film, whereas his attitude should be that the film is the only thing that matters. This really matters. I'm not saying this because I'm not interested in the music I write. I'm excited unless you're excited by what you're writing, you never write good music anyway. Yeah. But your main excitement is motivated by the film itself.
Rodney Bennett.
Well, I always try and use chamber groups if I can, because I think one can do so much with chamber groups. There's this unfortunate fallacy with film producers that the larger the orchestra, the better. But I think to a certain extent, the smaller the orchestra, the better, because it immediately you choose an unusual group, it has a character. It acquires a sort of colour of sound, which I try and choose for each picture.
And for Richard Rodney Bennett, film music has another advantage.
Writing film music, for instance, taught me things about music which I couldn't possibly have learnt if I'd just gone on writing serious music. It gave me an experience in orchestration, in communication of music to the audience, which I wouldn't have got otherwise. And this is why I have absolutely no time for the sort of snobbery which I'm afraid still exists among serious music, that one is somehow prostituting one's art, which, as far as I'm concerned, is a lot of rubbish.
And finally, Malcolm Arnold.
I tell you, the more I do, the more I realise that there's never a time. I thought some years ago that there was a time when one was experienced and one was established and you knew what you were doing, but it changes so quickly. Consequently, it's always interesting. It's always an enormous challenge, sometimes quite frightening, because musicians aren't usually in a position where they can either make or mar such an enormously costly thing as a film, and it can be quite a nervous strain to do the best that you get capable of, you know?
Yes, yes.
But it's always a challenge, and it's always interesting, providing you realise that you will never be established and you will never be able to sit back and say, I am a film composer, because tomorrow you might find out with a big shock that you're not.
That is the end of this film music edition of Talking About Music, in which you heard Kenyon Emrys Roberts talking with John Addison, William Alwyn, Malcolm Arnold, Richard Rodney Bennett, Sir Arthur Bliss, Anthony Hopkins, and Alan Rawsthorne. So this is John Amis saying goodbye from London.